This is the Honey Badger Diaries episode 34. My name is Aaron van Weer and I interview Bitcoiners about the coronavirus and other stuff I find interesting. You can find all of the episodes so far on thehoneybadgerdiaries.com. You can find me on Twitter at Aaron van W. You can find the podcast at Twitter at THB Diaries. And you can shoot me an email on thehoneybadgerdiariespodcast@gmail.com. Not really any news from me. We're still in lockdown. Well, sort of the soft lockdown kind of thing. Nothing really changed. Although I think they're starting to loosen up some things. Schools started this week, I think. I don't go to school anymore. I don't have kids either, so I'm not even sure. But I'm fairly sure schools went open again. I'm so happy I don't go to school anymore. I hated school. School was the worst. Like some kind of fucking prison. It's not that I didn't get along with the other kids or anything like that. Just having to be there every day, starting early morning. I'm horrible at mornings. I always was. Having to be there all day, not even being paid. Awful. I got a minor bit of news from the podcast front. You may have heard it if you listened to the last podcast episode. But I have an outro tune. Admittedly, outro tune is maybe a little bit of a big word, but I got an outro sound. So you'll hear it after this episode as well. My guest for this episode is, once again, Giacomo Zucco. You all know him. I don't have to introduce him, I think. I kind of wound up with Peter Todd and him in a Twitter thread, I think about a week ago, or maybe 2 weeks ago by now. 10 days ago, but I recorded the interview like 3 days ago, so it was like 1 week between the Twitter thread and the podcast. Anyways, my thesis in a nutshell is that while it is economically detrimental in the short term to take action and stop the virus, because people can't or shouldn't go to restaurants and bars and these kinds of things, either because the government stops them or just because they choose not to go, that has economic detrimental effects. But if you do that first as a society and get rid of the virus, or at least get it under real control, sort of what they're doing in Asia, then after that the economy can reopen in a much better way than if you don't take care of the virus. Because if you don't take care of the virus, then a lot of people just won't go to restaurants anymore, won't go to bars anymore. So that's sort of my thesis, but I'm not sure I'm right. I just find it plausible, or at least possibly likely, at least plausible. Now, Giacomo responded that we don't actually need to be sure about the answer because we can use praxeology, which I'll let him, I'm having him explain this answer in more detail in the interview, so I'm not gonna, but I thought this was an interesting answer because I really like praxeology. I just felt that maybe this was overstretching the potential of praxeology. By the way, if you don't know what praxeology is, we explain that in the interview as well. All right, so that threat was the reason for me to ask Giacomo back on. We had a discussion about the coronavirus and the economics of dealing with the virus. And I think about halfway of the interview, we both forgot that we were actually discussing the coronavirus. And it evolved more into a very general discussion about libertarianism, the non-aggression principle, property rights, these kinds of things. At least I forgot that we were discussing Corona, but I thought it was interesting nonetheless. So hopefully you might find it interesting as well. I'm just going to start the interview now. These are the Honey Badger Diaries, the Honey Badger Diaries. Giacomo, welcome back to the Honey Badger Diaries.
Thank you. Thank you for having me again. I hope I will not be too much repetitive.
We'll manage, I think. Happy Havening.
Happy Havening to you too. Yeah.
Did you recover from the celebrations?
Yeah, especially for the live stream. I was like committed. I double spent a little bit my time. So I committed to kind of four different live streams. Some couple in Italian, a couple in English. the big one was Tom Bates live stream. There was a lot of people like the Winklevoss, and yeah, it was fun.
Nice. Yeah, we had our own Dutch live stream going on with our the Bitcoin Show podcast, which was a lot of fun. Good people showed up. Plan B was there for a while, Sjors Provoost, and then a bunch of people that are well known in the Netherlands. We had a member of parliament show up at some point, which was pretty cool.
Well, I guess the lockdown made online meetings more incentivized in a way, right, compared to 4 years ago. And I hope to 4 years in the future, but that's, we will see.
Yeah, and I was on the Bitcoin Magazine stream as well. So yeah, I double spend my time a little bit as well. So I invited you back on because, we had a discussion on Twitter. It was really sort of Peter Todd, me and you. And at some point I figured, let's summarize sort of where we left off with that thread, shall we? So it was about, okay, so basically we were discussing the economics of the situation, of the virus situation and the lockdown situation. And in a nutshell, my thesis is that getting rid of the virus as a society is actually going to be better economically. Because if there's a virus going around and people perceive this virus as dangerous, which I think rightfully so, you might disagree on that to some extent, I'm not sure. But as long as people have this perception of there is a virus out there, then I don't think they're going to go to restaurants, go to bars. I mean, some people might, but I think a lot of people won't. Some people might not even show up to work. Like, it's going to have very dire economic consequences. While if you take care of the virus, then it's actually, on the whole, going to be better for the economy as well. So I would say it's definitely going to be better for sort of the health situation, but I think it's plausible and maybe even, I would say, likely that it's better for the economy. Now, you responded to that with an argument from praxeology, which I thought was interesting because I really like praxeology. But shall I let you make this argument? Or, yeah, and we should maybe, for the listeners that don't know, briefly explain what praxeology is. Right. So I made this argument basically that we're not sure which solution is better for the economy because, you know, we're speculating here, but this is my speculation. And then you argued that we don't have to speculate on it because we can establish it through praxeology, correct?
Yeah, that's correct. So basically there is a lot of points in which we can have a discussion and which we can disagree to some extent, but not even that much. But there are several discussions and one meta discussion. So the several discussion is about how much this virus is dangerous, or not absolutely dangerous, but more dangerous than other viruses. Because let's not forget that, for example, the seasonal flu is a deadly disease that kills millions. So the point is that there is a disagreement about how much danger it is. Then there is a
I would suggest that we skip that discussion that it's more dangerous and then have the discussion.
Absolutely. There. I was just listening, not entering that. So, but let's assume that it is really the most dangerous stuff my point was, let's assume that you don't disagree about this. And then there is another discussion that we can have about how effective, how realistic it is to just wipe out a new virus from the world without a vaccine. Let's agree that that's possible. We may disagree, but let's agree that that's possible. Even so, my point would be a meta point, which is basically that the assessment of the problem, the assessment of the best strategy to solve it, and the assessment of the trade-offs that you are available to sustain, the cost that you are available to sustain, and what you can give up in order to attain something, that is something that cannot be centrally planned, not because this virus is particular, not because this virus is not serious, but even if it's serious, even if the Black Death of the Middle Ages, and even if you have an easy solution to fight the Black Death, the praxeological point is more general, and is a point about knowledge, how knowledge is distributed, and about incentives and skin in the game. So what is praxeology? Praxeology is a term invented basically by the first Austrian economists. Basically, it was from Mises systematizing the term praxeology and cataplexy. Praxeology means a study of human action. So even if we don't know exactly what these physical properties of these objects are, or what is better as food, as medicine, as technology, even if we don't know anything about these, we can assume something at a very, very high level about how human act in general. For example, we know that human will try to maximize their own benefit and minimize their own suffering. We know that human will probably prefer among the same kind of value, they will prefer it earlier than later. So if you can have the same kind of value, you want it today, not tomorrow. If you want it tomorrow, is only because tomorrow you will get more than what you will have today. So the chicken tomorrow instead of the egg today. So these are very, like, in a way, common sense assumptions. They are not like scientifically proven, but you cannot prove assumption. The point is that, I mean, you cannot scientifically prove the scientific method itself. It's a method. You can apply the scientific method. And praxeology is also a method. It's just a method in which you use a very general, common sense, very easy to prove theoretically, but to falsify, and they are not falsified if you look around. They are empirically very well, very well substantiated, very well corroborated empirically, and use this assumption to build what is in practically a simple game theory. This is also something similar to the kind of objection that Hayek used in order to explain that the Soviet Union was going to collapse eventually. His point was not, I know better than experts that the Soviet Union is solid, is sound, because I know the economy of the Soviet Union perfectly. And there were a lot of experts, economic experts, that were actually swearing that the Soviet Union was going to go great in the 90s. And they were in like Samuelson, an economist which is studied as a textbook economist. He was saying just in the 87, so 2 years before the collapse, that the Soviet Union was going to be a role model for the world economy. So the experts studying details were saying so. And Hayek was saying, let's ignore details for now. Let's just assume what we know about very, very general problems and dynamics. And for example, the problem of knowledge. When you switch from a very simple problem and a very simple model from a very complex model, then nobody, no single person, has the knowledge about the whole situation, about the interaction between different moving parts and nonlinear processes that can build up exponentially and then crash down exponentially and so on and so far. So basically, this kind of study is the study of human action, which is praxeology, that makes just very simple assumption about the supply and demand and time preference and stuff like that. And you can build a very generic economic...
Let me pause you there real quick to paint a difference with what sort of mainstream economics often do. So the scientific methods, for example, which chemists will use, they'll formulate a theory, hypothesis about, you know, if we combine these chemicals with each other, then this, you know, chemical A and B will turn into chemical C. And then they test it in a lab and then it actually happens. So it's reproducible. And then they send the results to other scientists and they test it in their lab and the same thing happens. So economists can, a lot of sort of more the mainstream economic methodology is to do that as well. So they formulate a theory and then they go and test that by, for example, let's take the theory of a minimum wage, and then they look at different countries where they have different minimum wages and then they sort of test their theory against that. Now, an Austrian would argue that that's not very reliable. And I agree with that because there's a million other factors in both of these countries that could have caused the difference, which wasn't the minimum wage. And that's where the Austrians say, all things equal. So they just start with basic assumptions and then they don't go and test them in the real world. They just reason. It's a priori way of looking at the world. So if we would assume that the countries were exactly the same and the minimum wage is different, then in one country there must be more unemployment, because if the minimum wage is higher, that means that some employers can't afford their employee because the cost benefit isn't there. So it must be true, right? So that's sort of the Austrian way of approaching economics.
Absolutely. It's axiomatic deductive. So you start from these axioms that are very simple, very general, and you can argue they are very well, they are very sound and very well established by empiricism. And then use those instead of using stricter assumption, because typically the scientific method as used since Galileo, actually even before, and now systematized by Popper, the scientific method is you do observation, then you have a theory, and then you have to make a prediction which is repeatable and intersubjective. So everybody should be able to independently falsify this prediction. And if the prediction is not falsifiable and repeatable and intersubjective, so accessible to anybody, then it's not really science. It's more like metaphysics and stuff. And then in particular, physics is also about making a specific mathematical equation that can, so this prediction is not a qualitative prediction, like the sun will rise. It's quantitative. The sun will rise on that position where you can calculate the degree on the horizon, you can actually calculate the timing. So it's a mathematically quantitative prediction with equations. The problem is that in order to make work the math that we have now, that we had for centuries, in this way, you need the assumption of linearity. So that you can only do physical kind of, you can only do this kind of mathematical prediction quantitative, like in physics, when you have a linear system. So in thermodynamics, it works very well because a lot of nonlinear stuff, they cancel each other. But when you go to turbulence in fluidodynamics, then you have a lot of problems. So then you can still make some prediction, but it's very hard and they're very reliable, very difficult to test. And when you move from turbulence in fluidodynamic to, I don't know, field theory, like quantum field theory, when you have non-normalization, when you have more than one perturbative. So that, I'm doing a lot of technical terms, but the point is the more complex it gets, the more difficult it gets to be very scientific. But many so-called social sciences, they just decided to continue to assume linearity in everything, and they continue to ignore the fact that experiments are not really falsifiable, not really reproducible. And that's not just economics. Economics is a typical case of this. And Popper actually he called the mainstream economics as a pseudoscience. So something that wants to work as a science, but is actually not really making falsifiable prediction, repeatable by everybody, even if you assume that you have a very big sample of nation states, where you can try different policies, you have several problems. One is the one that you said, that is not really ceteris paribus. So it's not really that everything else is the same. You can do everything else is the same realistically with thermodynamic, because you reproduce the same pressure and temperature, and you assume that there is nothing hidden that is more complex than that. But you cannot do ceteris paribus, I'm doing like strange English Latin, ceteris paribus, everything else equal. You cannot do that with a different nation state. Also, there is the ergodicity problem. So a repetition of experiments is not the same as experiments done on the same time among different people in the sample. It's very different because, for example, if you do like Russian roulette and you do one bullet inside the gun, and then you take 10 people and you make them doing let's say 100 people, and they do Russian roulette, then you know that 1/6 of the 100 people will die and 5/6 will survive. But if you take one guy and you ask him to do Russian roulette for 100 times, then it's not the same, because at a certain point he will die and he will not survive for the time after. So time development of an experiment, time repetition and sample repetition is not the same. So this is not limited to economics. There are many social sciences that have this problem. Basically everything has to do with complexity. Climatology and nutrition, a lot of stuff actually, and medicine for sure.
Okay, so I think we agree there. In a minute, I'm gonna address some problems I see with praxeology, but let's first get to the other thing you mentioned and which you also refer to in your tweet, is that Hayek's criticism on the Soviet Union. So I think before, and I think Mises as well, before Hayek even. So before that, the first sort of criticism on communism was that with communism, people wouldn't have the incentive to actually work, because if everyone gets the same reward and there's no incentive. And Mises and then Hayek, I think, entered with a new argument, which was the knowledge argument.
Yeah.
And the in short, and you just mentioned this, is that the knowledge in society is very distributed. Everyone in society, like every business owner, knows what their customers want more or less. And then the producers that this business is buying their stuff from, then they know how much they need to produce. And like all of this knowledge is very distributed, while a central planner can never have this same level of knowledge. And that was the reason that the Soviet Union would ultimately fail, is because the central planner doesn't have the same knowledge that a whole society has, which in a market system, the society has a way of communicating through prices, right? So you agree? Okay, so how do you apply this to the virus situation now?
It's very similar. So you have, let's make at least two kind of big topics. One topic is assessing the risk, assessing the problem. For example, there is a lot of complexity in how you estimate the seriousness of the virus. Maybe you're underestimated, maybe you're overestimated, but the point is that locally speaking, there is a lot of if you do a test over your hospital, you exactly know where you are applying the test. If you are measuring, for example, the test bias, if you run the test for COVID-19 over the general population, you get something around the 0.5 case mortality rate. If you apply that inside hospitals with people that are already symptomatic, you have a higher rate. If you apply that only in intensive care, where people are critical, you have a higher case mortality rate. And of course, if you apply the virus test in the morgue of the hospital, you will have a 100% case mortality rate, basically. So you know which kind of methodology you're using in your hospital. It's not easy to have the same kind of knowledge when you mix up numbers from all around the world and you take decision based on that. Then you know how your specific population is reacting, maybe based on average age. For example, people in Italy are older than people in the Philippine Islands. And then there is climate. We know, and we are seeing that right now, even inside Italy, that pathologies, especially viruses, they react a lot to seasonality, because ultraviolet light will kill the virus in the surface, and people will gather in closed space more if it's colder. So there are a lot of factors there, and we know that this factor can be less or more important, but they are basically always there. So you know that more at the local level. The knowledge about that cannot really be effectively emulated by a WHO supercomputer, where you just assume that some politicians that are not even physicians for the most part, physicians, they do just assume local knowledge, they elaborate it centrally, and they get a perfect picture. So the first problem is assessment of the risk. Maybe my criticism is not that the central planning is always overestimating and overreacting. My criticism is that, for example, at the beginning, they underestimated the coronavirus crisis, because, for example, the WHO at the beginning said it was not a big deal, it was not out of China, it was under control, masks were useless. So sometimes it's underestimating, not overestimating, and sometimes it's overestimating.
Sure.
Then the even most important part, when the knowledge in order to have the estimation of the problem is somehow assumed to be there, then you have the difficult part, which is which strategy you have to choose in order to fight it. And that's where really the knowledge and the incentive problem are very, very big, because only, my parents They have one. They have one scale of values. For example, where they decide that seeing their granddaughter is worth a risk of X. But for example, going to shop is a risk which is lower. Some guy who is very old, for example, he will be very likely exposed to the risk of coronavirus, but also he will be sacrificing less expected, less life expectancy because it's older. And so maybe for him, spending the last 3 months of his life inside a home alone, completely alone, is not worth it, while the risk to die of pneumonia going out is better in this situation. The assessment about what you want to give up in order to do something is clearly better managed at the individual level or small community level. And then the last part is like police, like enforcement excesses. When I post videos on Twitter of policemen, four armed policemen, aggressing a man and taking these two infant children in a stroller out of him because he was just working outside. This kind of situation is the product that when you create a law centrally, people will just blindly apply the law without any kind of common sense because you're just creating this centralized diktat and then everybody's just assumed to apply that without reasoning. But if you have people reasoning at local level, it's also police enforcement that becomes different because every policeman will have to assess practically locally. So that's my general point.
Right. So there's two things I want to say on this. And I think the most logical thing is to start with praxeology because that's also what I promised to get to 3 minutes ago. So let's get there first, praxeology. I really like praxeology. I think if you want to do economics as a discipline, praxeology is the way to go. However, I think you also need to be careful with praxeology because it's easy to gloss over or miss things sometimes. I actually got this. So I got a couple of arguments from the Bob Murphy podcast. You know who he is, right? Robert Murphy?
Yeah.
Yeah, and there was a guy, his name was David Henderson. So he came on the show to argue this. And I thought his arguments were very good. And he wasn't opposed to praxeology either, but he said the same thing as I'm saying. Like, you got to be careful with it sometimes because you sometimes miss things. So one of the arguments he gave was the all things equal. Paribus celibus? No, what's the term,
Giacomo? Ceteris paribus. Ceteris paribus.
Ceteris paribus, yes. That's nice in theory, but it is sometimes very meaningless in the real world. So the example he gave was if you have a kid that's doing karate and he promotes to a new belt, then, you know, he goes, I don't know what the order of belts is, but let's say he goes from blue to brown, whatever, he levels up. Now an Austrian or the all things equal would say, you know, that doesn't make him a better fighter, he's, you know, it's just the belts that changed. However, there's this psychological effect called the winner effect that just giving this kid the new belt actually makes him feel more confident and makes him, you know, put in more effort and makes him a better fighter. So all things equal, the belts didn't make him a better fighter. Like, if you just take it at face value in sort of theory, you know, how would a belt possibly make someone a better fighter? However, in reality, it actually has a sort of psychological effect, and therefore it does make him a better fighter. So you could take this argument to economics by, for example, and I'm not saying this is true, and he wasn't saying this is true, but you could argue that, for example, the raising the minimum wage could have a psychological effect on people, that they feel supported by their government and they feel like, okay, you know what, I'm getting paid better now, I'm gonna put in the extra effort and I'm gonna be a better, more productive worker. So the Austrian sort of all things equal argument would say, no, all things should be equal. So the psychology shouldn't change. However, in the real world, the psychology changes. So things, it's interconnected. Do you see what I mean? So the argument of all things equal just sort of sometimes falls apart in the real world because they just aren't equal, even though they're discounted by that claim.
So I think this is a very, very fair criticism, but I'm not sure at all this is a criticism which should be directed to praxeology in general, because I would say it's the other way around. So when you talk with an econometrist, and these econometrists, like these mainstream econometrists or macroeconomists, will try to create a model, and this model will either prove or
But I'm not defending that at all.
No, sure, I know, but the mainstream economics can tell you that the minimum wage will help or it will hurt. Then you can basically try to apply this criticism that you don't know about second order effects, about psychology, about self-fulfilling prophecies. But praxeology is the other way around. Praxeology is, let's not make any assumption about which kind of first order effects we are finding directly and which kind of hidden second order effect we are not counting. Let's just assume what we reasonably can assume about people, like that this little kid will probably prefer, again, sorry if I use the same example, but because it's simpler, will prefer to graduate from blue to brown earlier than later, and other things equal. So you assume that you know something other things being equal, but then you use that as a limitation of your knowledge, not as a base to build very specific models. So what you do in praxeology is you destroy certainty, and so you create more fuzzy models that are way less useful. So admittedly, when you do praxeology, what you basically say is, I don't know. And so you don't produce very, very useful predictive models, but you stay very, very aware of fake assumption. So when you talk about, for example, minimum wage, you don't say, I know that this worker will work the same. You don't make a ceteris paribus model and you say that's true. You say that ceteris paribus, something will happen, and that's reasonably true. And then you also put that into the global reality, where you don't know which things are changing and which things are not changing. And then you go higher level and you search for what physicists would call the constants of motion. So, for example, the question that you ask praxeologically is, what kind of new economic resources are you creating with this movement? How likely it is? So even assuming that there is an optimal level in which the psychological benefit of incentivizing psychologically the worker is overcompensating the loss of competition because you are cutting out other works from the chain, which is the fine-tuning level where that becomes optimal? And the praxeological thesis is, you cannot realistically achieve that level because you cannot know that level. And if you even knew that level, you don't have the incentives to keep that level from corruption, laziness, and stuff like that. So the point is not, I can prove you that if you put minimal wage, this will go wrong. But I can prove you that you don't know which level is right, and you cannot realistically know in the complex system which level is right. So there, if you add an all-powerful supercomputer / God knowing everything and with perfect honesty, so you could put a minimum wage which is precisely in the level in which it hurts a little bit the competition among workers, but it also help the self-confidence of the people. So you can probably fine-tune and you can find a better result. So it's like, if we all jump together at the same moment, we can change the Earth rotation axis in a way that will overcompensate for climate change. That's true. The point is that I know that you can't, because you don't have the knowledge. And if you don't have the knowledge, you don't have the incentives to transmit this knowledge honestly among different layers of corruption and self-interest and problems like that. So the point of praxeology is not to say that the absence of minimum wage is perfect, but that any kind of attempt or pretense of knowledge about which is the right minimum wage that will work is flawed. It's a little bit, if you, I don't know if you are familiar with the Monty Hall paradox in statistics. It's kind of mind-blowing if you think about it for the first time, but then it makes sense. So it goes like this. There is a contest and you have three doors, and behind one door there is a Lamborghini, and without the other doors there is nothing, like a goat or nothing. So the host of the game will ask you, choose a door, A, B, or C. And you say, I don't know, choose one, Aaron. A, B, or C?
B.
You say B. So now the host, knowing what is the disposition of the prize, will open a door which contains nothing. So now I open the door A, and I show you that there is nothing, and I knew that, and you know that I knew that. And now I tell you, do you still want to keep the door B that you chosen before, or you want to switch to C? What do you do?
Yeah, I switch.
Yeah, and you're right. Why? The simple explanation is that it's when you have one third to be right and two third to be wrong, you have to bet on the fact that you were wrong. So praxeology is like that. You don't know where the Lamborghini is, but you know that you're more likely wrong than right. And so you have to decentralize decision information because you know that you will probably be wrong.
Yes. Okay. I don't think we necessarily disagree there. And to recall my Twitter thread that started this conversation, that was sort of my point. Like, we don't know.
Yeah.
Like, I'm not sure that I'm right, but you can't be sure either. And praxeology can't prove that you're right either. Like, we're both speculating. That was sort of my point there.
I agree. I'm not trying to prove I'm right. I'm trying to prove you're wrong. So the difference is not really symmetrical because, but yeah, admittedly, in our Twitter discussion and in other Twitter discussion about coronavirus crisis, there was a lot of overlapping between different layers. So I have some thesis. So I think that the virus is this deadly and not this. So I'm putting on a lot of hypotheses, and then I'm also putting on the general praxeological approach. And I think that the general praxeological approach is right because the only content is that we are likely wrong. And then as an economical agent, I'm not just supporting the praxeological approach, but also trying to make my own hypothesis. But the main methodology, the main point is that I should not be able to force you into behaving following my assumption. So that's the whole point.
Yes.
We should all be free to compete with different assumption and different. Of course, I think that my assumption is always that the government is wrong, which is, if you think about that, it's like a Monty Hall paradox. The government is probably wrong because it's trying to put a simple solution globally without information or knowledge. So it's not that the government says choose the door A, it's always the door B. But it's more likely not the door A. It's more likely either B or C. So the point is that you're not locked down versus another very simple. So the government puts one simple answer, which is the lockdown. I'm not putting another simple answer. I'm playing unfair in a way. I'm putting as an alternative any kind of other answer you can have, which is not exactly that. And I know the government is wrong because statistically speaking, in a complex system, the policy of the government is always wrong, because some of the millions of other policies will be right for that context in that moment.
Okay. So, and this is why when you tweeted that, it did make me think, and it made me, I had to think why you thought this knowledge of society proposition was applicable here. And I figured that this probably had to do with a much bigger topic of libertarianism and how far you want to take sort of the logic of libertarianism. Now, let me first address the other point I wanted to mention before, which is this risk assessment that everybody in society would take for themselves and the rewards of, you know, going out anyways and these kinds of things. Now, I think the big difference here is that with this virus, for example, it's not just a risk for yourself to go out. You're also potentially risking others. And this gets to the much bigger topic of libertarianism, I think. and of the non-aggression principle and these kinds of things. So let me just first ask a very simple question. Do you think the non-aggression principle applies here? Like if you infect someone else, that isn't that a form of aggression?
Aggression usually means that you know that you are trespassing and you do that. It's about knowledge and intention as well. So in a way, let me make this other extreme example.
At the very least, Giacomo, you must know that you might carry the virus.
Well, but you already know that you might carry another super deadly virus. You might. The point is, what is the actual probability? So let me give you an extreme example. We know about the overused example of the butterfly effect. So chaos theory, climatology is very weird, very nonlinear. So a butterfly moves its wing in New York, and then you have a typhoon in Manila. And the typhoon in Manila will kill people. And maybe it's not a butterfly, but maybe it's you, Aaron, working around in the Netherlands. And you working here and not there will actually cause a typhoon to kill people in Manila. The point is that this is so, the ability for you to predict that that's true is so insignificant that you cannot be really held accountable. Then from here, you have a series of degrees. For example, now you go out. So let me try to build this kind of spectrum. On one side of the spectrum, there is Aaron walking in his home, even in the Netherlands. And this is actually killing, because if it didn't work, there was not a typhoon hitting Manila. And this is physically possible by the extreme. The other extreme example is Aaron takes a gun with six rounds, and he goes out and he takes a random bystander and you point it to his head while it's turned around, and you shoot and you kill him, because a headshot, you kill him for sure. So in this case, you are just a killer, an aggressor in an obvious way. In the first case, you're not. But then you can make a very big degree you can make a spectrum. For example, now you go out, and instead of six round, you just put one round, and then you have 1/6 of probability. You are still a bastard, probably. You should still be locked up. But then you have 1,000 guns, and just one gun with one bullet and 1,000 gun. You go around, you will probably not hurt anybody for an entire year, because the statistics say that you will not, but then you're still risking other people's life for nothing. But then, for example, you are a guy, so now you are like a knife throwing artist. So you go around in the streets with your accomplice and you throw knives, and you're very good, and you know that you will not miss. But one time every 100 years, you will actually slip and kill a bystander that was just watching. That can happen, but it was clearly not intentional. Your purpose was to be entertaining and you couldn't know. And then you go again and you have a driver, somebody driving a car, and you can have a stroke and you can kill somebody. And then there is moving on the stream, there is the COVID-19. And then there is the new pandemics of 2022 that you're already carrying, but you don't know that because it hasn't been discovered. So my general point is, in this spectrum, it's true that you are affecting others, but the point is that the level you can be held accountable to that is the actual level of probability of affecting others at our best knowledge. And my point about COVID-19 would be, for example, that if you are doing a barbecue alone in a park, like our friend Francis was doing in Canada yesterday, the probability to affect in that way somebody unwilling in a way that will seriously damage them is really comparable to the probability of it's orders of magnitude bigger than driving a car and having a stroke and killing people by driving a car. So everybody driving a car is probabilistically violating the non-aggression principle in a way, but it's reasonable to, the way the force you can use to stop somebody to do something which is risky is proportional to the assessment of risk at our best knowledge, because driving cars is dangerous.
I totally agree with that, but that, there is gray area, but that leaves us with the problem that who gets to decide what is reasonable. You can't just leave it up to the individual themselves, right? Like, you got to have some sort of framework or...
Yeah, sure. That's a problem of humanity since always. And the kind of solution which is closer to the acknowledgement of our limited knowledge and our distorted incentives, so the praxeological truth or praxeological assumptions, if you may, the closure system is the typical system of tort law in which, of course, everybody is deciding according to his own knowledge, which is the base layer. But then there is the second layer in which the guy that thinks that he suffered some kind of unfair aggression, he will have to respond proportionately, and then other people in society will. So let me put it like this: you drive a car, you have a stroke, you hit me, and you break my legs. So now I will react, trying to get compensated from you in a proportionate way. And I involve the community around us, which is the community which is most likely knowledgeable of who am I, who are you. And we will create the tort law system, the customary law system, which is basically people trying to take care on each other and trying to check if somebody is aggressing or if somebody is proportionally reacting to an aggression. And then a lot of stuff can evolve from this. And this is not a theoretical, this is not science fiction. This is, I mean, the interesting point about this discussion about libertarianism is that somehow it feels like we are proposing a new utopistic way to manage tort law. But that was historically the way the tort law developed over the centuries, and only after, and only very recently, after the French Revolution and so on, and especially in the 20th century, people got the crazy idea that they can actually codify and centralize these with one single bureaucratic structure. So the drunkenness, the pretense of knowledge about one single global legal framework where everybody will just apply the law as zombies, as robots, and it will be better than people managing locally and case by case. It's very, very recent. It's something that basically happened. I mean, it was we can discuss history right now. But my point would be that you can easily show that any society started with tort law, and only very recently there was the culture of centralized civil law, which is usually producing worse result on average than tort law was.
You may please explain or re-explain this first part, because it just sounds like a state, just a smaller state. What's the difference?
That's all the difference. So in a way, it's a little bit about the argument that the way Nassim Taleb is managing this public discussion, I really don't like it. I'm at the opposite front, and I think he's applying the opposite version of what I'm proposing. But his previous idea about politics, he said that the point is not really libertarian or fascist. I can be fascist or communist with my 2-year-old son or daughter, because she doesn't even know if she will die if it gets down the window. So I will be fascist, taking her out, taking her liberty to do that. Then I can be probably more like democratic in my building, because we have a few families and we can be democratic and decide voting. Then I can be minimalist Republican at my town council level, because there can be voting, but there will be some kind of common structure. Then I can be libertarian at my county level, and then I can be anarchist at international level, which everybody already is, because at international level there is not a single state that can manage all. So the point is actually it's right. The point of the state, the point of the modern nation state, is not really the concept that somebody can actually interfere with anybody else. So there could be an extreme pacifist ideology, which is if you see a serial killer killing a child in the park, you do not intervene because that would be anti-libertarian. That's a pacifist extreme, which I not subscribe. The point is that you can step in to defend the child from the aggressor, but when the people stepping in is people who is taking orders from somebody in another city, which doesn't even know the child or the aggressor, and was not there in that moment, and was just making a general law that everybody who is going to a certain place, for everybody who is black is a criminal, so you just arrest all the black people, or everybody who is not in possession of this government paper is a criminal, so now all the criminals in possession of this paper, they can just go around freely and they can just rob everybody. But the few good people not in possession of this, maybe an illegal immigrants, they will be criminal because they don't have the paper. So every time you abstract from the rational context of the intervention to prevent violence, so you can use force, proportionate force, to prevent or punish violence. But when you move from the individuals and the small, sizable communities, you go to the level of the ideology of the nation state, this is when everything changes, because this is, you can see that even, for example, in the Middle Ages, there were a lot of wars. People was at war all the time, but everybody knew that they were fighting for this free town or this king or this feudal lord or this bishop or this monastic abbot. They knew that was like person against person. They have name and surname of the guy they were fighting against or with or for. When you switch to French Revolution, then you say, you're not really fighting against one man or for one man for some specific reason. You are fighting for a generic principle. And this generic principle, the only time where you can actually mass murdering and genocide and the Vandian genocide, because it's not clear anymore who is taking the decision. But it's clear, but you cannot say it anymore. The head of the Jacobin commission will not be a man. It will be just a representative of this volonté générale, this abstract concept that will be used in order to scale up to. So the idea is that you pretend that you can scale justice over the local case, which I think is anti-praxeological and it's false. And of course, praxeological principle doesn't. So local justice doesn't always work. It fails. It fails a lot. But the point is that nation state justice, it will fail more.
Right.
Not less.
Okay, I think I agree with you again on many of these points. You know, even in the Netherlands, you see that here in Utrecht, we have to deal with laws that are clearly come from sort of the Christian tradition, while there are very few Christians here. So why do we have to deal with that? That's a good they can have their Christian laws in the Bible Belt. That's fine. Like, why do we have to deal with it in Utrecht? So I think that's sort of the line of thinking is what you mean. So let me then turn it around and ask, what does need to happen on a nation state level, if anything? Like, what kind of laws or what kind of regulations should happen on the nation state, should it exist at all?
I don't think it's reasonable to expect that at that level there may be any kind of reasonable intervention. What you can have, in my opinion, at that level is just voluntary kind of organization. So you can have a church, but it's like a church that you can opt in and opt out. So you can have a moral guidance, which is overall the. So you can have Scientology and the Catholic Church, and you can have a lot of different churches. Then you can have maybe Freemasonry lodges and clubs. You can have the Rotary and the Lions. You can have companies like you can have Google and Facebook and Microsoft and Tesla. And of course, these companies will not be what they are without state intervention, because you know you have patent laws and incorporation laws. But anyway, let's assume that corporations are a natural consequence of market. I think they're not. But you can have that kind of things. You can have Coca-Cola selling shit to people. But you cannot have Coca-Cola arresting people if they don't drink Coca-Cola. That's all the difference that you need at global layer. So at the small local layer, you can have force to punish and to prevent aggression. But at the global level, national level, I don't think there is any single justified field of intervention of a forced centralized planning.
So let me give you the example. And when I was mentioning the Bible Belt and Utrecht as a difference, for example, I was thinking of something like growing weed or selling weed, which a lot of, I don't do that anymore, but a lot of people in Utrecht would do that, but it's banned because the Bible Belt doesn't like that sort of stuff. So for me, that makes no sense that we're not allowed to do it here, while, you know, everyone here is fine with it, you know, just ban it in the Bible Belt. But something like property rights, that's needed if we want to exchange, you know, if we want to have a market with people in the Bible Belt, for example, right? So property rights, is that not something that should be managed on a state level?
Yeah, that's a very good point. What I find troubling of some libertarian thinker is that they assume that you can extend competition even on the principle of competition itself. So you can have basically, you can compete between competition and non-competition, which right. is a logical fallacy, of course. Property rights are not a specific. Property rights are not like you should do this, you should cultivate weed, you should smoke weed, or you shouldn't. Property rights are, you should only decide of the proportional bubble of which you have direct skin in the game and causal interference with. So the point is that people should be constrained to act where they do have direct homesteading and skin in the game or explicit voluntary contracts. This is a general principle. Of course, this principle can be enforced globally in a way, but it's different from a state. It's not a giant libertarian state because I can demand that everybody everywhere applies a non-aggression principle. But I cannot demand that they appoint my policeman to enforce it, and they choose my court, my specific judge, to assess if it was not violated. I cannot force my specific organization as a monopolist of law application. Of course, the law is still the same. I think that the property rights are universal. You just use the logic. There is something which is called argumentation ethics, which was developed by Hope and Kinsella, which is the point is that basically when we discuss and we debate and we argue over some scarce resources, for example, my body or your body or my land or your land, we are already assuming that there is an objective principle to distribute these resources in an objective way, which is usually the homesteading principle. So the first guy manipulating the land, it's like Bitcoin, right? You have proof of work, you generate the coin originally, and then you have a signature to transmit it. So in libertarian theory, there is a homesteading and contract. With homesteading, there is an objective physical link between some unappropriated natural resources and a moral agent acting on the resources. And when they act, they have the right to defend and to enjoy the physical consequences of their act. And the second principle is contract. So when you own some, I grow a tree of an apple tree, I own the fruits of the apple tree. Now I can promise you that will not interfere from you taking from that. So I'm giving that to you, or I can give you a conditional promise. So I give this apple, the rights of this apple tree to you, only if you promise to leave to me the rights for your banana tree. So you can exchange and you can have, but it's very basic. It's probably, you can probably codify all libertarianism in three principles, basically: homesteading, voluntary contract, and proportionate reaction. Because of course, if you take my apple and I shot you with an atomic bomb, that's clearly not proportionate. But when you go into more nuances, to define what is proportional, it's more tricky.
Yeah, well, let me address that, because libertarians do claim the sort of non-aggression principle often, but this first point you mentioned is a form of aggression, right? You just think it's legitimate, but it's still, you're aggressing against someone to sort of keep them to these first two principles.
Well, this is terminological disagreement, let's say, but for most libertarians, I mean, we can go either way. It's just words are just words. We just have to agree about the meaning. Most libertarians.
Well, let me just very briefly put it like this: if someone would disagree with point one or point two, then what's left is aggression against this person.
In order to be clearer, I will not call it aggression. I will call it reaction with force, proportional reaction with force.
But from the perspective of this person that disagrees with point one or two or both, it's aggression against him.
That's a good point. So I think that the deep point you're making is that non-aggression principle is not really well defined. We use it all the time, but it's not really well defined because it's dependent on a property right theory. So if you don't have the property right theory shared, then non-aggression principle is arbitrary. For example, I come there and I punch you, but I'm just claiming that your face is mine, so I can just punch it because it's my property. There was people actually doing this. Like, there were people in America taking black people from Africa, and they were like, I'm just defending my property because you just happen to be my property. So your body is mine. So don't aggress me. So if you go to free a slave in the cotton camps USA before the abolition, you were told to be aggressing the rights of the slave owner, which we think it's crazy, but it was normal, and people was even thinking it was utopistic to make it stop, and it wasn't, of course. Like I think people now think it's utopistic to make nation states stop, but I don't think it's utopistic in general. It's just probably going to last for a while. So you're right. Property rights theory is probably the most fundamental theory of libertarianism, and non-aggression principle is just dependent on that.
Yes. Well, you mentioned the example of slavery, but I actually do think there's also a reasonable counter argument to this sort of property argument, which is the Homesteading principle. I don't see the Homesteading principle necessarily as something, you know, definedly true or anything. If you sort of, like Austrians like to do, take the Robinson Crusoe example, then at some point there were people walking on the earth and they were picking fruit and they were hunting for animals and they were, you know, living their life. And then at some point, someone somewhere says, hey, from now on, this is my land and I'm going to grow stuff here. And now you can't walk on this land anymore and you can't hunt here anymore and you can't pick fruit here anymore. So from land that was just there before humanity and that was sort of commonly used, someone started to say, no, you can't come here anymore, and I'll use aggression against you if you step on my land. So this was just a claim on a common resource, which is sort of where the whole reasoning from the non-aggression libertarian argument starts from. So I think that starting point is questionable, and I think it requires force.
It does require force. But it's not, and so your point is that property rights, like homesteading principle, is arbitrary in a way. Just culturally, it's just a cultural arbitrary, definition that somebody came up with.
More than arbitrary, because I think there's a good argument to be made for it. But I would say it requires force. So the non-aggression principle is kind of bunk if you assume that it starts with aggression, actually, for this homesteading principle.
Again, this is a terminological discussion. So the non-aggression principle is not primary, is derived from the property rights theory, from the homesteading principle, for example. But once you accept the homesteading principle, then it does require force to enforce it, but it doesn't require aggression, because of course you define aggression only as the violation of property rights, and not as a proportionate response to defend it or punish the trespassing.
So, yeah, but that's semantics, then. From the perspective of someone who disagrees with the homesteading principle, which I think is also a good argument you can make that argument as well, then it's aggression from that perspective.
Well, again, the point is how much arbitrary is the homesteading principle. And I argue that it's not arbitrary at all. And I argue that logically speaking, it is the only way to agree objectively about scarce resources that is also universalizable. So the only ethics which is universalizable is actually the homesteading principle and the contract principle. And every other ethics is actually arbitrary. That is not a proof that the homesteading principle is true. This is only a proof that any other form of universalistic ethic is false. So it's very subtle. I cannot prove that we have to agree about Amsterdam principle. I can prove you that there is no other non-arbitrary way to agree about scarce resources. And this is, I mean, we could talk 3 hours about this, but I think this is a very solid point. Of course, if you disagree on this, then I think we disagree about everything. But I think that I can prove you that your disagreement is inconsistent. I cannot prove you that my theory is right. I can prove you that your theory is wrong again.
Yeah, okay, let's I want to throw in another counter argument then against sort of this way of thinking, which is sure. That there is no realistic way, given where we are at this point in history, to realize this in anything resembling fair from the libertarian standpoint, because we've had thousands of years of history where the sort of non-aggression principle, if you want to apply it, has been broken time over, you know, again and again and again, with land invasions and with wars and with, you know, theft. And like, it's been going on for so long that the only way that we could sort of move to this libertarian utopia where there's no aggression or something like that is to say, okay, you know what? Bygones are bygones. And from now on, you know, this is what it is. Whoever owns whatever they own right now, that's just, we're going to start from here. But that just sort of legitimizes all of the crimes of the past. So the people that don't have property right now, you know, they're screwed. And maybe it was stolen from them or their parents, or, you know, so there's just no real way of actually turning this into any sort of reality unless you want to somehow forget all of the wrongdoings in the past. Wrongdoings from the libertarian perspective.
So I think there are at least two points here. The first point is a general objection that I think is a fallacy, which I try to explain with a comparison. The comparison is with medicine. So if you are a medical doctor, a physician, you understand that there is an objective distinction between physiology and pathology. So there is the body as it should work without illness, without sickness, and then there is the pathology. And you can objectively, there are some gray areas that you can argue over, but there is an objective difference between being sick and being healthy. And you can easily agree objectively on that. But then, is it even possible to have perfect health over a population? I mean, over a certain time frame, over a scale population? No, there isn't. So you can never arrive to perfect health, but that doesn't mean that health is undefined or unrealistic. You fight to have the better kind of health that you want, and you will never say, you know, this sickness was always here, so it's good that it's here. So people, I mean, children should die of smallpox because it was always that way, so they should. No, they shouldn't, and if we can fix it, we will fix it, and then maybe they will die for something else, but we keep striving for more and more health and less sickness. So for property rights is the same. Libertarianism is not a theory about the fact that sometime there was perfect property rights respect and now there is some kind of alien situation in which somebody's breaking property rights, and then we can arrive to a utopia where property rights will be perfectly respected again. Crime, the thing is that bad things always happen, so the evil always happens, and a subset of evil is crime, and a subset of crime is organized crime, and a subset of organized crime is mafia, and a subset of mafia is national government. So can we fix national government? Maybe. We did it with slavery. Can we fix crime in general? No. So property rights will be violated. But what I do as a libertarian is, A, I do not violate it. I try to live my life without ever knowingly violating other people's rights. Then I try to stop people from violating mine the way I can, the best I can. It's not possible to do that perfectly. And then I try to help others to defend others from aggression if they are innocent and they are aggressive, the way I can, of course, in this order. So I feel like libertarians are like doctors. Doctors do not tell you that there will be an utopistic moment in which nobody will die forever. They just tell you that you should strive for more and more health, which in the metaphor is more and more respect of property rights, even if it never be perfect. So the second point of your question, which is,
let me stop you there, because I want to ask a very fundamental question then. Is libertarianism, is the goal to achieve freedom for people, or is the goal property rights in itself? It's freedom, right?
This is a very difficult question. I think that this is a very bad marketing, but for libertarianism, but I think that the most logically correct answer is that it's all about property, logically, rationally defined property rights.
Okay, that's surprisingly honest, because I think so too. Like that's what it sounds like to me, that it's about property rights instead of freedom.
Because freedom, you can literally, freedom is a word that is very, very ill-defined and very abused. So I could add, in order to support the marketing effort of libertarianism, I can tell you that property rights are the only framework to define freedom in a logically consistent way. But if we talk about the term freedom, people say that they were killing others for freedom. I mean, I am not free because you are not giving me your stuff. So I'm not free to use your stuff. So I kill you, and that's freedom. And people actually did use this. I mean, in Italy, the fascist movement was all about freedom, and the Soviet movement was all about freedom. And I mean, if I'm an Islamist terrorist, I'm free you from the crusader influence of America or Israel, big Satan or whatever. So freedom can be arbitrarily defined. I think that if you try to define freedom consistently, then you are basically back to property rights.
Why?
Which are not, because there is no other consistent way to, basically, the point is that any other ethical theory assumes that I cannot argue with you because you don't own your body, basically. So if we discuss, you have to assume that you can control your body to discuss with me. So we are starting to do the first step about libertarianism, which is I cannot move your mouth while you talk with me about resource distribution, because otherwise we are not really debating. I'm assuming that there must be a logical way to give to each one his own. And if I assume that and I develop that consistently, basically you arrive to the only kind of objective link you can make between a person and the physical process is time precedence, because that's the only consistent way to distribute, which is also, funnily enough, sociologically speaking and empirically speaking, that's the way we also work. Like if you go to a beach, and let's make this example. You go to a beach, you put down your robe on the beach, and you just stay there, sunbathing and sleeping, and somebody arrives with a giant stereo in your ear and start to dance with very ugly music. In that case, you will yell at him, "Leave me alone, I was here before." Then you have another example, which is somebody going to a desert beach and starting to dance with the music. And then you have this boring old party spoiler who arrives and say, "You have to stop because I have to sleep here and I have to put here my robe." So even children understand time succession of people who first establish a physical link with something, especially if they're putting effort in that link, they will have the priority into enjoying this kind of resources. Any other principle, I cannot prove this principle, but I can show you that it's logically consistent. You can apply this principle and have a functional society. For example, equality principle, that can never be applied consistently, because even if me and you can be equal, we cannot be equal with people who was born before, and we will born on planet Earth in 1,000 years. Even if we take the land and we divide the land for each 7 billion people on Earth, then there will be more people being born after, and they will not have a land unless you redivide every time. And then all the people that was on Earth before, they will never be made whole for the third they suffer. So there is not a consistent way to apply any kind of ethic logic unless you do homesteading. So the reason you can debate with me using your body is that you as a moral agent, made homesteading of your body muscles and bones before. And I think if you apply this consistently, it basically it works. Of course, doesn't mean it's always simple. In many cases, it's not simple. Like physics is not simple. If I have to measure things and to decide which is my property and which is yours, there will always be debate and gray area and disagreement and conflict and injustice. It's unavoidable. But at least there is a consistent principle that you can approximate, while every other ethical principle is demonstrably incompatible with universalism. Assuming that we want universalism, for example, I want universalism. I want to think that every moral agent on Earth is the same. Of course, if you think that, like, if you are a white supremacist, or if you are like a religious fanatic that thinks that only some soul deserve property and other are subhumans, in that case, you don't want universalism, and you can make a racist ethics or some other kind of hierarchical ethics. But if you are universalist, homesteading principle is really the only consistent way to go.
Yeah, well, that's a lot to unpack, and I'm not going to unpack it all. I think one thing to mention is that there's an assumption on moral agency there, and that brings me back to a whole different Twitter discussion we had at some point. Because so there's assumptions hidden in there is what I want to point out. So, you know, it's self-consistent if you take certain assumptions.
That's true. For example, the very challenging one is who is a moral agent?
And right, exactly. Isn't.
Like, is a black man is a moral agent or not? Because somebody in the 17th century will say no, and I will say yes. Is a child under 2 years? And under 1 year and under 0 years, when it's just 8 months of development inside the uterus of his mother. So there is a lot of debates on that. And I think that there is a logical way to apply a precautionary principle there. So everything that could be a moral agent should be considered a moral agent. But this is tricky because then you have animal rights. So can you kill bacteria when you take antibiotics, or you are committing genocide of bacteria? And so some people will... So what I usually do is I try to find objective singularities, objective discrimination points. For example, if you take one cell of my skin, you can in theory grow an individual from that, in theory, if you do stuff on that, because you just clone myself. But if you take a baby out of like a 2 years old baby, he still die if you don't feed him or protect him, but the level of let's do it like this. There is a clear biological discontinuity between my cell and a fetus, which is a conception and creation of a new organism with a new DNA, etc., with telomerase reconstruction, etc. There is no literally any kind of discontinuity before, and no clear discontinuity after, in my opinion. For example, birth. It's not clear, it's just a geometrical thing. You take a guy which is inside the uterus and you take it out, but it's not really a biological discontinuity. You can take it out, operate surgery and put it back. And doctors do that. They take the fetus, they take it out, so now it's alive, it's human, and then they put it back. So it's very tricky. And the other thing that you could say is animal right? So is there a clear singularity between a bacteria and a medusa, or a jellyfish? I would say no, not clearly. Like, jellyfish are just very, very elaborate colonies of cells that are eukaryote, but just... And then from a jellyfish and a spider, well, it's not much different. A spider and a lizard and a squirrel and a monkey. But then from a monkey and a man that can discuss with you, there is clearly a historically unprecedented discontinuity. Like, everything changed on nature, philosophy, between the monkey and the man. So I think
I would disagree with you, because there were other types of humans, and there were, you know, there were the Neanderthals and there were others. And, you know, some of them were probably at least somewhat capable of reasoning or of thinking. And, you know, so even though if you look at the sort of current situation, then... I would just agree with you, but it gets, even that gets fuzzy if you go back into history, far into history, and you, this black and white sort of clear distinction that you want, it, there's just, you're gonna end up with gray areas somewhere.
I agree. It's always fuzzy. My point is that this is the less, the naive discrimination point that, that anybody not educated will choose is actually the less fuzzy discrimination. And all the overthink that educated people made are actually more fuzzy than this. So my point is, between Neanderthal and monkey, it's fuzzy. The same for example, a brain injured child and the monkey, maybe the monkey is more intelligent than the brain injured child, but the brain injured child is a child. So there is gray area there, but everything else has more gray area. My objection to that is that if you don't assume that as a discrimination, which is the traditional discrimination between people and stuff, then you will not end anywhere and you cannot take antibiotics anymore because you are committing genocide of bacteria.
Yes. So I think this is one of the points we diverge then, because you want to find this sort of self-consistency and go as far as possible as you can to find this self-consistency, where I at some point conclude, okay, there's going to be gray area and there's another thing we can look at other than self-consistency, which is desirability. Like, how desirable is, you know, if you follow a line of reasoning, then how desirable is the conclusion from that line of reasoning? So to give you an example about, to get back to property rights, if you sort of equate property rights with, you know, that's how we define freedom, that also means that someone without property has no freedom, right? And if
you cannot have somebody without property, you can just have smaller property. At the very bare minimum, you have your body. So it's
okay,
still,
but I think
always have some property.
I think freedom is a desirable outcome, and I think we can sort of try to define freedom as, you know, being able to live your life in the way you want.
But that's property, like that's interacting with physical reality in the way you and not somebody else wants, which is, yes, my point is that it's not that that's inferior to property. That is the definition of property. You can influence some part of the world in a way that is just yours and nobody else can interfere.
Not if you don't have any property. So if someone has more property than someone else, that means that the person with more property has more freedom than the person with less property, right?
That's true. That's
so
correct.
There's not equal property, not equal freedom then. Now there's all sorts of consequences from this. For example, someone who's born into a rich family, someone who's born into a poor family, have different levels of freedom,
which
to me sounds undesirable. Like, that's not an ideal situation. It would be ideal if there was equal opportunity, for example.
But my point about consistency is that you cannot even define desirability consistently. I mean, if you give up
consistency
is not the only thing, but is a fundamental thing. If you give that away, it's not sufficient, but it's necessary. For example, perfect equality of property, you can see is not desirable because, for example, you and me, Aaron, we are clearly incredibly beautiful. I mean, our body is handsome. And some other men, especially in the Bitcoin community, they are ugly. And so what's the point there? I mean, can we have equality of property of our body to have the same kind of beautiful facial features that me and Aaron have? No, we can't. I mean, they can use these as an excuse to disfigure us, but this is not desirable. The desirable thing is that there is an asymmetry in property. Sometimes this asymmetry is about merit and deserving something and building something. Sometimes this is just out of luck. And I'm short, you're tall, you have more property than me to play basketball and do other stuff. I mean, that sucks, but I don't have the right to cut your legs in order to be as tall as you. It's not my right. It's not desirable for me to live in a world where people will, where I can cut your leg to be the same height, and people will just, I don't know, people will just shave my few remaining hair because they are completely bald, and so on. There is an intrinsic asymmetry in property that you cannot really reduce. And I am not free to grow very, very thick front hair anymore. I was free to do that a few years ago. Now I'm not anymore. And if yes, I can do that with science, I will. But if I can't, I cannot take it from you.
Sure, but Giacomo, there's you gotta agree there's a difference between nature, you know, the world around us as it is, and something like property, which is ultimately a social construct. It's just ultimately something we agree on, and we've reasoned about why it should be that way. But it's not, we're not limited by nature to change how we define property.
Well, I think that's a very, very huge gray area, because we can change, for example, our body is natural, but we can change it a lot. We can change it surgically, genetically. We can change it a lot. We can, if somebody eats more, it will increase muscular mass, and then he will be better at playing some sports. And
that's, you can change it within limitations, though.
Well, that's true even for nature. Nature is not really arbitrary. The fact that it is debatable doesn't mean it's arbitrary. The physical link you can build with homesteading is not arbitrary. It's not that people just, it's like a little bit the discussion about money as a shared illusion that some Bitcoiners get crazy when they hear that, because shared illusion is a very common meme, but that assumes that what can become money or not is arbitrary. So if somebody wants to use
sushi as money. No, it doesn't at all.
Exactly, it doesn't. My point is that property rights are not arbitrary. They are very strictly defined. Of course, facial features are very obviously difficult to change. I mean, you can change it with surgery, but they are very obviously not dependent on your merits. While the amount of land that you own maybe is more dependent. For example, some property are dependent on state intervention. If Microsoft have the right to take your stuff because you are using a CD of Microsoft Windows that you find on the street, and you didn't sign any agreement about not using that, but Microsoft can send armed men to hurt you if you use that CD, that's clearly not property. I mean, that's called property, but I will argue that that's a non-consistent definition of property. What I mean is that the property rights as the foundation doesn't mean that everybody who says property rights is also right. Because of course the mafia will come to you and they will say, you know, you have to pay protection money because this is our land. But it's not true, it's not their land. They're just saying it is because they want to take your money. So it's not that anybody talking about property is right. What they're saying is that there is a consistent definition of property that we can make and approximate, never perfectly. We will mess up, we will abuse it, we will disagree, we will fight, we will have injustices. It's not a perfect word. It's just a better word than any alternative.
Okay, I want to move on to, I think we've sort of established our disagreements, where you're very focused on self-consistency, even to the point where I think some of the outcomes are clearly undesirable. And I think even though undesirable or desirable is also a fuzzy concept, it's still something I like to take into account.
I agree of this disagreement. Let me add just a point. If I ever listened to an alternative property definition that doesn't give me the weirdness of one guy being very rich and the other being very poor. I mean, you feel some kind of weirdness. You think it's okay if somebody's ugly, somebody is good looking, but it's not okay if somebody is a billionaire and somebody else maybe born into being billionaire and somebody else is starving. So yes. this weirdness that you feel, I can't find any kind of ethical theory that consistently makes that disappear, except for libertarianism, which I think will reduce this kind of differences more than statism.
Yes, but Giacomo, even if it, like, that's your expectation and that might be true, but the point is that even if that would prove not to be true, then your moral framework would still allow it that some people would starve to death and other would be billionaires.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, absolutely. Unless you can find me, I mean, I cannot prove libertarianism. I can just prove the inconsistency on any kind of other ethics I've heard of today. If you can find me another discrimination point, another consistent, so consistency is a requirement. It's not sufficient. if you bring me another consistent ethical theory, I will accept that if it's less weird.
Yes, well, I'm not even completely convinced about the consistency, but for that I would, oh yeah, I guess we mentioned that about the, because it, that derives from the moral actor, what was it?
Moral agent.
Moral agent, right. Okay, anyways, let's leave this, because I want to work towards an end, and I think you had to, well, anyways, you had until 5 or something, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, last point, let's get back to the virus for a second. So, one thing I'm seeing a lot of the sort of libertarians in the Bitcoin space do right now is, or just libertarians in general, is sort of claim their rights in this moment of time, right? They have the right to assembly, they have the right to all of these things, and whatever the government, you know, the government shouldn't be impeding on their rights to go out or to run their business or whatever. And I think I morally, ethically, I agree with that. Like, yeah, it's kind of weird that all of these sort of fundamental rights are all of a sudden just sort of brushed aside, it seems, at least in some places in the world. And I think they're very right to be claiming these rights or to be arguing in favor of these rights. At the same time, I also think that people right now, and I would like to see them claim that as well, that people have a responsibility, that if, because I do think there's a risk, but even like, let's just assume there is this risk, as we did at the start of this conversation. Let's assume the virus is dangerous. Let's assume all of that. Let's assume that, you know, staying at home, for example, or social distancing and these things help yourself and help other people. Then I do think it's also a responsibility for people to take. So just claiming your right right now, even though I agree you should have the right, it also seems very, I don't know if it's egocentric or simplistic, but it, you know, that's the other side of the equation. Like, people should take responsibility as well. Even though, yes, they have the right, I would like it if people took more responsibility.
I agree with you. I think the symmetry there is twofold. The first symmetry is that is when you're talking. Again, as we discussed in our first conversation about this crisis, and also as you discussed it with Mir, we remember still very clearly that in February, we were pushing people to be over cautious compared to my, for example, my other family members, my sister, they tend to be more statist than me. So when me and Mir were pushing for caution in February, they were like, oh, whatever, this is just the flu. And we were, no, it's not, look at this. This is something different. This is at least 10 times the mortality. Maybe it's a little bit less, but back then it looked like 10 times. So we were over cautious. And Mir called her parents from Las Vegas in 20 of February and said, stay home. And this was not forced in Italy until a month later, but we did it 1 month before, and that was responsibility. But when you when you have the central planners violently imposing the same solution with some components of obvious arbitrariness, like you cannot go alone on the beach looking at the sun alone, when you arrive to that point, it's clear that you cannot make that distinction anymore, because this trumps the other. Like, if I'm free, I can tell you what I will do. But if we have one central planner imposing violently over everybody the single solution, the priority is to break this, and then I can explain you that you should stay home. And it's even, I think it will produce more damages, more long-lasting damages. And also, it's prior, before you have to let me do what I want, and then I can tell you what I want, and I can update this knowledge. And then the other asymmetry is what I told you before, that there is not really the state proposal and my proposal. There is the state proposal and a network of incredibly different proposals. And I may pick one, and then I can change my mind. But the point is that fighting tyranny is not one principle. Is taking away one forced option to experiment every other option, including that one that you took away at the personal level. So the priority of fighting tyranny over staying home is that staying home is one of the possible things you can do. It's probably reasonable, but up to a point, because for example, if you stay home, but then the virus doesn't disappear, and then you get out, then you get sick. So the point is, why is better to get sick later? And there may be very good points for that. For example, not spreading the curve, to not overload the health system, or you just live 1 month longer. I mean, if there was like a sickness killing 90% of the population, staying home doesn't solve anything. But if you stay home, you live 1 month more. What do? You stay home, even if there is no solution, because it's reasonable to have more life than less. So there may be very good points to stay home, but there also may be very bad points to stay home. For example, if you know 100% that you're going to starve if you stay home, and you know that you have 0.001% to go to die for pneumonia if you go out, you go out. So the point is that, it's not really a matter of only freedom without responsibility. But unfortunately, it's very difficult to put them on the same foot, because freedom is very simple. You should not impose me, you should not be tyrannical. That's very simple to explain. While you should probably stay home unless you think it's better to go out, and you should use a mask, but not really a mask that you reuse, because, I mean, there are so many nuances. There is not a simple formula for fighting a virus, but there is a simple formula for fighting tyranny, which is just don't be tyrannical.
Yeah, well, I agree with the just don't be tyrannical part, at least. The thing is that here in the Netherlands, the rules that are imposed on us, like if the rules weren't being imposed, then it wouldn't affect me at all. Like I'm already doing what's required. Like I was already doing that. So it's, I guess I don't really feel the sort of fire in me to go and fight it, because
you would do that the same, but it's totally different. It's like we were saying before about the Soviet Union. It's not that, so the party, the Communist Party in Soviet Union, they were deciding that people would need bread and haircut, and they were basically assigning, you are a hairdresser and you are a baker, and they were assigning jobs because they had a design. People left free, they will still want bread and haircuts, and they will still become, so they will want the same thing. But the difference is not what you want. The difference is at what level you can fine tune your decision. So you will probably stay home the same. So it's irrelevant for you. I mean, me and Mir, except for traveling, if we were in Milan, we would stay home all the time anyway. Nothing changed. But the point is that you can micromanage the little choices, and it's easy to dismiss these little choices, but they make all the difference between a monoculture of zombies doing the same thing that can create a lot of tragedies, or a population of things that are free to change, and then maybe they will do the same for a certain time, but then a single guy, he will decide to do something different. He will get rewarded or punished by reality. And so others will learn and follow the example or not follow the example. If you arrest this single guy, everybody else will always do the same. So the importance of the outlier, the importance of the single guy thinking differently. There is the, like, you know, the, there was like the I don't remember how to pronounce it. Anyway, the film with Brad Pitt about zombies. And there was the moment in
World War Z, I think.
World War Z, yeah, thanks. And he was in Israel, and in Israel, he speak with the guys and the bureaucrats and the politician, and they said that they had this tradition of having the 11th or 13th man. So when everybody in the room agree about the strategy against terrorism, the job of this man is to disagree and to assume that everybody else is wrong, so they can implement a plan B in case everybody else is wrong. This is the natural consequences of freedom, actually. It's funny that a nation state like Israel tried to replicate that bureaucratically, but this is already the natural consequence of freedom. And with freedom, if everybody's scared, everybody will stay home, unless somebody will not, for a different risk assessment, and then people will try to compare different solutions and to follow what works more and to ditch what works less.
Yeah, well, I haven't thought this through entirely because it sounds like a good idea, but at the same time, wouldn't that just mean that the virus would sustain in this case through this small minority and then the rest is locked down, then the rest has to stay in longer? I think that would be the argument, right?
That this is a very could be an argument, but it's a very, very weak argument. I think even assuming this argument is true, is still again Monty Hall. We know that that the our probability to exactly pinpoint who can go out and who can stay home in order to max to minimize the time of the virus on the earth would be probably fallacious. I mean, we know that because it's way more probable that we are wrong about that than right. So we have a knowledge argument, a pretense of knowledge argument against that. But even if I go beyond this meta argument, I think that the idea that, I mean, if you have doctors and nurses going to treat people with this problem, and then you have policemen going around and taking people very close contact, often without masks, and then you have criminals, how do you make sure that criminals stay home? So the point is that, and then you have journalists and politicians. If you notice, in any lockdown country, politicians and journalists, they can go out free. Like in Italy, yesterday there was a big picture of 300 journalists interviewing the mayor of Milan while the mayor of Milan was complaining for 500 people assembling in another place. So you can never really, in a complex system, the simple solution is wrong. So if you break down the complex system into simple system like you and your family, probably you can find a solution which is less wrong.
Well, yeah, the thing I was wondering about, the argument in favor of your approach is that the minority that would, for example, not apply social distancing, they would either die or build herd immunity between them. I'm just
Exactly.
wondering how much longer that would take for the rest to social distance at home, or anyways, I think that's
But not so. I mean, the libertarian answers are not always very nice. You can ostracize people. If there was a movement that was like never, so if you stay home, you draw you have this pin, the stay home pin, and you don't speak with anybody who doesn't have this pin. So, of course, you have to check on it. But my point is social ostracism, boycotts. These are very libertarian solutions. Libertarians doesn't mean that everybody does what they want and we don't criticize, we don't boycott, we don't ostracize. Maybe I want to stay home, and if you I mean if you tell me that you don't want, then I will stop meeting with you ever because I don't trust your hygiene, your virus hygiene anymore. So it's not a problem. That's a good libertarian approach. The only problem is that I come to arrest you when you try to do something different, and that not only that, but the decision of what is different is taken at the central level, in which you have the paradoxes, the unavoidable paradoxes of the guy working alone on the street with a stroller and five policemen taking the stroller away, which is not just about the virus, because last 3 days ago there was a or 4 days ago, no, the May the 4th, the Star Wars Day in Canada, there was the new laws against the firearms. So there was a girl dressed as a Star Wars stormtrooper with a fake, obviously fake plastic gun. And then five policemen, they arrived, they draw the guns, the real guns against this girl. They started to cry. They told her to get on their knees, but she couldn't because of the body armor. And then they assaulted her, breaking her nose because she was dressed as Star Wars. So when you see that, you just ask, how
Oh,
can somebody be so stupid?
sure, there's
That's
a
only
There's a lot of excesses. Like, I totally agree with that. And there's a lot of illogical rules, but I also still think it's a complicated problem. For example, the button you mentioned, like, people can just lie.
Sure. That was a
So.
very stupid. That's what. But let's say, for example, some people like to show off on social media because they want to. I mean, they want to show they are rebels. So our friend Francis, they will go out to do the barbecue and they will post the barbecue stuff. So a good reaction to that, if you think that barbecues are danger alone in the park, empty park, are dangerous, I would question your sanity. But if you do think that, You know that, and you just avoid Francis forever. Of course, somebody can go out alone and hide it, but there is a very low advantage in living. Like, I mean, it's very close to, I mean, I think that people are already going out lying anyway. The point is that if they are lying and if I'm hiding that, either the police can probably not stop them because they are just doing that stealth mode. I mean, I've been, well, I will not comment about that, but it's possible to go out in stealth mode.
Right. All right, Giacomo, let's make an end to this.
Yeah, I have to go.
I thought it was interesting. Thanks for being on again. You're allowed to go out now, right?
I'd like to go, but it's a funny story. It's already public. I told some friends. So in theory, now people can go out still with the certification, but with a, so you still have to give the policeman the reason you're out, but the number of reasons are now now larger. So basically you can go, for example, to do sport in a park very far from your home. So basically it's just the array of reasons is so large that policemen are not really checking anymore very strictly. So people now is working around. But I went to my home, my apartment is Switzerland, on Friday morning. I asked the guys on the border, can I enter with my residency? They say, yes, sure. Everybody was entering and exiting for work. So I entered, but when I exit, they told me, but yours is not a work permit. It's a residency permit. So we don't know if you're coming out today from this morning or if you were in Switzerland all this time. And I told them, no, I'm in Italy since March. We don't know that. So now you have to go home and quarantine yourself for 20 days, taking your body temperature twice a day. Otherwise, you will be criminally charged. So now I am personally quarantined for 14 days home. And in theory, I could not use the same room as Mir because otherwise I would be criminally charged. So that's the problem. So I cannot go out for 2 weeks, but that's a very personal situation because I went to Switzerland one day.
Right.
But Mir can. Mir can go out.
Right. Okay, well, good luck with that.
Thanks.
And I'll talk to you later sometime.
Sure. Bye. Cheers.